Omaha Public Radio presents another lecture program from the Center for Faith Studies on Noon Forum. We'll hear a talk by Scott Russell Sanders, Distinguished Professor Emeritus of English at Indiana University, where he taught from 1971 to 2009, and author of A Private History of Awe and A Conservationist Manifesto. He'll speak on the topic, The Way of Imagination. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Thursday evening, October 13, 2011, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of the Center for Faith Studies, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the program is Eric Elness, Senior Pastor at Countryside Community Church.
The theologian and writer Eugene Peterson observed many years ago that for people of faith whose largest investment is in the invisible, the imagination is absolutely indispensable. For it is by means of the imagination that we see reality whole. It's where the visible becomes joined with the invisible, the matter becomes joined with spirit, and through imagination also heaven and earth come together. I suspect very shortly we'll be finding that heaven and earth have come just a little bit more together in the words about imagination, Dr. Sanders. Without further ado, let me bring forward Cindy Kidman, who's the director of the Center for Faith Studies, who will make the formal introduction. Thanks.
It is wonderful to see all of you here tonight as we enjoy the second in our series of lectures for 2011-2012, and especially the fourth annual Radical Amazement Lecture. Many of you are familiar faces with these lectures, and some of you are here for the first time, and we're especially happy to have you with us. Please join me in extending a warm welcome to Dr. Scott Russell Sanders, our honored speaker this evening. If you read his bio in the program, you will be amazed at his long list of awards and achievements. It's quite impressive. I also want to publicly thank Tracy Bridgeford and John Price, professors at UNO in the English department, who were gracious enough to say yes quite enthusiastically when I asked them exactly 1 year ago if they would be interested in working together to bring Dr. Sanders here to Omaha. People ask me a particular question a lot. Where do I get the ideas for themes and presenters for this lecture series? I'm pleased to tell you that the Radical Amazement Lecture theme grew, well, organically. In 2009, we invited Richard Louv, author of Last Child in the Woods, to speak because his message seemed compelling and ageless, that we just have to work harder and smarter these days to keep our children and ourselves connected to nature, and for very good reasons, that the spirituality of childhood is directly linked to free play and time spent in nature. One thing led to another, and we saw immediately that exploring the bond that human beings have with creation, the wonder and awe that we experience, and how directly connected that is to our relationship with the divine, and presto, we had an important theme to explore yearly, and with a Radical Amazement title right at the top of it. So back to the question, where do we get our ideas for the specific presenters? Often from the pastors with whom I work, or books I've been reading, or have recommended to me by friends, by colleagues, even my own children. Ideas have also come from other presenters themselves. But how we discovered Scott Sanders is the most interesting story of all. I was asked by a young aspiring author in Alaska, a complete stranger to me, if I would read his manuscript of his first book. It was about faith and sandhill cranes, by the way. And if I would make comments. So he sent it to me by email, and it already showed over in the side that someone had used the computer system for tracking changes and comments, and this was all in the margins. And the remarks in the margins were identified by a number, not by a name. And I enjoyed reading the remarks as much as the manuscript itself. And it was a wonderful manuscript. But here was someone making the kindest remarks, offering the most supportive encouragement and gentle suggestions that I could imagine. One thing led to another. I asked about who the mystery person was behind the remarks, who read this manuscript for the very young Alaskan author.
and it was Scott Russell Sanders. And before long, I had read four of his books and invited him to come visit us. Dr. Elness developed a plan for our congregation to explore Hunting for Hope, one of his books, of course, to explore this in small groups and through a sermon series, and the rest is history, which brings us to this evening. I tell you this long, convoluted story to lead us together to my point, that we never truly know just how connected we are, how our yearnings and wonder unite us, that we respond deeply to mutual experiences in the natural world, and how we often speak in the same languages. But sometimes we struggle to find the language to express our awe and wonder. And then we turn to poets, musicians, artists and writers and actors who give us the words or the means to express our radical amazement. Please help me welcome Dr. Scott Russell Sanders.
Thank you, Cindy. I'm grateful to Cindy Kugler and to Eric Elness for inviting me into this place and to give me the opportunity to write the piece that I wrote for sharing with you tonight, and also to John Price and Tracy Bridgeford at UNO for inviting me there and for sharing in this joint invitation. Abraham Heschel, who is the source of the phrase radical amazement, a wonderful Jewish theologian, flourished especially in the 1940s, 50s, and 60s. And he said that at the root of all religious searchings is the perception that the universe is an astonishing, wonderful place, terrifying as well, overpowering as well, but at root, amazing, astonishing. And his writing has meant a good deal to me because that's a feeling, that's an awareness I have carried from childhood. And I hope a little bit of that comes into this tonight. The piece is called The Way of Imagination. And here it is. Not long ago, while visiting a Midwestern college surrounded by a glacial plain that had been scalped of trees and planted to corn, I sat down to dinner one night beside a retired banker. He was a silver-haired man, as befitted his occupation, well up in his 70s, dapper and soft-spoken. We eased into conversation by exchanging the usual male data about our careers. His spent handling million-dollar deals in a corner office several dozen floors above the hubbub of Chicago. Mine spent stringing words together in a corner study two floors above a quiet street in Bloomington, Indiana. Our talk gradually deepened through the salad course and the main dish and the dessert. And finally, as our coffee arrived, he confessed that he had piled up far more money than either he or his offspring needed, and he had puzzled for years over what to do with all that excess. Not a problem all of us have, but it was a problem he had. And not from any sense of guilt, he hastened to add, but from a sense of stewardship. Since he had come by so much money, he felt responsible for using it wisely and not merely to feather his own nest. His own nest, he said, had quite enough feathers already. Then one day the answer had come to him. He would purchase, cut over forest land, hire sturdy young people to replant it with native hardwoods and place it in a conservation trust designed to ensure that the trees would grow unmolested as long as the sun shines and the rain falls. So far, he had acquired and begun replanting several thousand acres. In two or three centuries, he imagined, the recovering forests would begin to resemble those that the first European settlers had found when they came to America. It pleased him to think of children in that distant day romping among the big trees. This seemed to me a noble idea. Curious about his origins, I asked if he had spent time in old-growth forests while he was growing up. No, he answered. He had only read about them as settings for the adventures of fictional characters like Natty Bumppo and historical figures like Daniel Boone. Since launching his land-buying project, he had visited a few ancient groves all at a distance from Chicago. But these glimpses from boardwalks or paved trails amid the chatter of other visitors or the groan of machinery from nearby roads, these glimpses only hinted at the glorious picture he had formed through his boyhood reading of the forest that had once covered most of the country east of the Mississippi River. Did I realize, he wanted to know, did I realize that in 1800 or so, a squirrel with sufficient stamina and wanderlust could have set out from a treetop in Massachusetts and scurried on westward from branch to branch all the way to Illinois without ever descending to the ground? Smiling at this scenario, I replied that I had heard of such a possibility. And did I recall the opening of Longfellow's Evangeline? Only vaguely, I admitted. So he quoted them for me with surprising fervor, as if he were a schoolboy delivering an oration. This is the forest primeval, the murmuring pines and the hemlocks, bearded with moss, and in garments green, indistinct in the twilight, stand like druids of eld, with voices sad and prophetic, stand like harpers hoar, with beards that rest on their bosoms. What I long to do, this man proclaimed, ignoring the quizzical glances from our fellow diners, what I long to do is help restore a bit of the forest primeval. Since that dinner table conversation, I have reflected on the retired banker's vision and on the leaps of mind required for him to reach it. First, drawing only upon words and books, he had to picture a kind of landscape he had never seen. Then he had to look at the terrain that had been lacerated by clear cuts or whittled down to spindly forest thickets and imagine it slowly mending and maturing over several hundred years into a forest that matched his childhood picture. And finally, he had to relish the prospect of strangers not yet born savoring the big trees centuries after he himself had returned to dust. The first of these imaginative moves, the transfer of vision from a writer's mind to a reader's mind, exemplifies the power of art, a power as astounding and as easy to ignore because of its familiarity as the flow of energy from the sun. We forget how remarkable it is that feelings and thoughts originating within the artists and given expression through language, sounds, paint, film, clay, wood, or some other medium, stir up thoughts and feelings in those who encounter their work. It is a kind of telepathy. The artists might be long dead, might have lived at a great distance from us, might not have shared our gender, nationality, race, class, or other traits, and yet we can be entranced by the art they have made. We might thrill to the portraits of animals they left upon the walls of caves. We might laugh or weep over the characters they launched onto stage or screen. We might quote their words to a lover, shimmy to their music, or view the world afresh because of their paintings. Like the steady influx of sunshine that powers our planet, the energy of art animates our inner universe, attuning us to beauty, sharpening our perceptions, enlarging our sympathies, and tempting us to become artists ourselves, if only by sporting a beret we saw a movie star wear, or by humming a tune as we changed the baby's diaper, or by arranging flowers in a vase. What comes through to us from a work of art is not a simple transmission of what arose within the artist, but rather a new impression refracted differently through the lens of each individual. No one who strings words together into novels or poems, for example, can foresee how they will be read by the neighbors next door, let alone by future generations. When Cooper sent Natty Bumppo into the world in 1823, or Longfellow sent Evangeline in 1847, whatever else they intended, they could not have dreamed that their tales would inspire a man in the 21st century to restore vanished forests. The second sort of mental leap my dinner companion made was one that propelled him backward and forward through time. As we sat there at the table, he was able to picture how the eastern hardwood forests might have looked in 1800, and able to envision what forests allowed to grow unmolested might look like in 2300. Although destined to live, in all likelihood, fewer than 100 years, he was able to hold in his mind a span of 5 centuries. What he knew about the earlier condition of the land, from a time before the onset of indiscriminate clearing and plowing and paving, offered a model for what his wild sanctuaries might become if they were allowed to recover. He had never actually watched the desolation of stumps turn into a healthy forest with giant trees and abundant wildlife and romping children. He could only imagine the prospect, but that was enough to set him working to make it real. Scientists are the ones who exercise this time-traveling ability most rigorously and ingeniously. By studying fossils and geological strata, by examining samples of rock from the moon and Mars, by calculating the rate of decay of radioisotopes, by measuring the level of cosmic background radiation and the distance to the outermost galaxies, scientists have compiled a story of the universe that stretches more than 13 billion years from the Big Bang to the present. With less certainty, they can extrapolate that story beyond our moment into the future. So, for example, by analyzing air bubbles trapped in the ice of Antarctica, scientists have documented changes in temperature and carbon dioxide levels within the Earth's atmosphere over the past several 100,000 years. They have demonstrated that higher levels of CO2 are associated with higher global temperatures. They have shown that the current percentage of CO2 in the atmosphere is the highest in 750,000 years. And as a result, they can predict with a high degree of probability that by continuing to burn fossil fuel and level forests, we will increase average global temperatures, thereby melting glaciers and polar ice caps, raising ocean levels, altering patterns of rainfall and drought, displacing or extinguishing other species, and making the human future more precarious. Whether the silver-haired banker knew in any detail this 13-million-year story of the cosmos told by science, I can't say. Even if, as seems unlikely, he happened to believe that the world is only 6,000 years old, as reckoned by a 17th-century Irish bishop who counted the begats in the Bible, he respected science enough to consult with ecologists about choosing suitable tracts of land and the appropriate mix of trees for his visionary project. In our conversation, he spoke of what he had learned from scientific studies about damage from acid rain, threats from invasive species, use of controlled burning, and other variables. He knew that if his forests were to thrive, it would be through a combination of human knowledge and nature's resilience. This ability to envision and work toward a desirable outcome, an ability we exercise every time we plan a picnic or design a house or begin a sentence, this ability is another distinctive human power, as vital for our well-being as the ability to make and experience art. Equally vital is our ability to change behavior in order to avoid an undesirable outcome, quitting smoking to reduce our chances of developing lung cancer, say, or banning the use of lead and gasoline to prevent brain damage in children. Humans are not unique, of course, in being able to learn how to achieve a desired result or how to avoid an undesirable one. Rats can be trained to push a lever to receive a bit of food or escape an electric shock. Dogs, horses, dolphins, parrots, chimpanzees, and any number of other animals can likewise be trained to perform amazing feats through the use of rewards or the threatened or actual use of punishment. But what if the reward or punishment were not delivered to the animal being tested, but to some other animal, and not delivered right away, but 3 centuries from now? Would any species other than Homo sapiens take action in the present, especially action that is costly or risky, with the purpose of benefiting strangers in the distant future? Here we come to the third imaginative leap accomplished by my dinner companion, which was to care about the well-being of people to whom he bore no relation, who would never thank him, never read a plaque inscribed in his honor, never even know his name. Caring for strangers who may be separated from us by a gulf of time or space, by religion or race, by some other seeming barrier, caring for strangers requires the active form of empathy we call compassion. It requires us not merely to hurt when others hurt or rejoice when they rejoice, but to alleviate their suffering if we can and to foster their happiness. Even if these efforts cost us money or time, even at the risk of our own comfort or safety. Acting compassionately toward one's immediate family or blood relatives is relatively easy, although not universally practiced. Doing so on behalf of one's cronies or class or tribe is harder. Hardest of all is to care for strangers. But caring for strangers is precisely what the most widely known ethical principle in the world asks us to do. The name for it, the handle for it, is the Golden Rule, which goes like this, and you know it. Do unto others as you would have them do unto you, it declares, without placing any limit on who the others might be. Variations on this principle can be found in Hinduism, Buddhism, Confucianism, Taoism, various Native American traditions, and many other traditions, as well, of course, as in Judaism and Christianity. The versions of the rule that I absorbed as a child were those attributed to Jesus, as when he said, as quoted in the Gospel according to Matthew, "Whatever you wish that men would do to you, do so to them. For this is the law and the prophets." The logic of this instruction seemed clear to me as a child. If people are hungry, feed them. If they are ailing, heal them. If they are vulnerable, protect them. If they are outcast, embrace them. If they are fighting one another, make peace between them. For wouldn't you wish to be treated likewise? According to the gospel accounts, Jesus practiced what he preached. He told his followers, "Love your neighbor as yourself." And he demonstrated what that meant by treating with respect and kindness all whom he met, prostitutes and tax collectors, lepers and high priests, children and elders, women and men, and even those who sought to kill him. On one occasion, and you remember this story, on one occasion, a lawyer, perhaps unsettled by this high ethical standard, love your neighbor as yourself, a lawyer asked Jesus, "And who is my neighbor?" In response, Jesus told the story of the Good Samaritan, who proves to be the true neighbor by showing mercy toward a Jew who had been robbed and beaten and left for dead beside the road. Others have passed by the victim, perhaps afraid that the robbers might still be lurking, perhaps not wishing to interrupt their own journeys. But when this Samaritan, a foreigner who would not be expected to help a Jew. When he came upon the injured man, we're told, he had compassion and went to him and bound up his wounds. It's a beautiful passage. He had compassion and went to him and bound up his wounds. Jesus concluded this tale by telling the weary lawyer, go and do likewise. As I carried these teachings into adulthood, I realized that the wounds in people, places, and earth are limitless. But I also realized that acting compassionately does not require us to heal all wounds, only those within our reach. More abstract versions of the Golden Rule have been formulated by philosophers, most famously by the German 18th century philosopher Immanuel Kant, in what he termed the categorical imperative, which goes as follows. Act only according to that rule whereby you can at the same time will that this rule should become a universal law. More plainly, Kant was arguing that one should act in any given situation as you wish everyone would act in a comparable situation. The cautionary version of this principle might be, don't do anything you wouldn't want everyone else to do. Don't cheat, lie, steal, poison the air and water. Don't squander Earth's bounty, leave a crippling debt or a heap of radioactive waste for future generations, because surely you would not wish to live in a ransacked and toxic world populated by cheaters, liars, and thieves. The Universal Declaration of Human Rights, adopted by the United Nations in 1948, proclaims that every member of our species should be treated as we ourselves would wish to be treated. More recently, the Earth Charter has extended this ethical principle to include our fellow species, along with the waters and soils and atmospheres on which all life depends. Far from the rarefied zone of philosophy and international covenants, a version of the Golden Rule has shown up lately on refrigerator magnets and bumper stickers. It goes like this: be the change you wish to see in the world. It's often attributed to Mahatma Gandhi, although scholars have not been able to find a text where Gandhi actually wrote something, those literal words, although it's certainly in keeping with the spirit of Gandhi's teachings. This maxim has been widely embraced because it provides a rationale for acting on one's values, no matter how small the effort may seem in proportion to the change one seeks. If you want our nation to be devoted to peace rather than perpetual war, then conduct yourself peaceably. Let go of grudges. Help settle quarrels. Refuse to see others as enemies. Write letters to the editor. Petition your members of Congress. Keep vigil on the courthouse square. If you wish to break the grip of industrial agriculture with its reliance on petroleum and poison, then plant a garden. If only in a few pots on a windowsill or a few square feet in the yard. And buy as much of your food as you can from local growers. If you want coal companies to quit ravaging mountains and spoiling streams, then use less electricity. Push for enforcement of the Clean Water Act. Put solar panels on your roof. Enlist your neighbors in the cause. Do whatever is within your means. You will be told that such gestures are trivial in the face of social and global pathologies. You will be told that it is pointless to ride a bicycle to work when others are commuting in Hummers. I know Omaha has at least one red Hummer. I saw it today. You will be told that it's pointless to ride a bicycle to work when others are commuting in Hummers, to replace your incandescent light bulbs with fluorescents when China is building a new coal-fired power plant every week, to witness for peace on the courthouse square when the Pentagon doles out contracts in every congressional district and the U.S. accounts for nearly half of the world's military spending. But the reason for acting compassionately is to manifest your highest hopes for the world, regardless of the odds that the world will be transformed. Why wait to do what you believe is right until the majority shares your belief? Not everyone can do something as grand as buying thousands of acres and replanting trees. Not everyone can sit in a legislature or boardroom and make decisions that affect whole economies and whole societies. But whatever you're standing, you can seek out others who share your concerns and aspirations, and you can join with them in actions great and small to defend what you love and to bring more of what you love into the world. When technicians try to figure out how a given device was made or how a given effect, say in a computer program, was achieved, they call their effort reverse engineering. They reason backwards, delineating the steps necessary to produce the desired result. I have been engaged here in a kind of reverse engineering. Not of a device or program, but of a hopeful human gesture. I want there to be more old-growth forests. And so I seek to understand what moved a person to work for their restoration. I also want there to be restored wetlands and prairies, clean and free-running rivers, oceans teeming with life, and every manner of wild habitat where our fellow species may thrive. I want our own species to flourish in cities and settlements where the air is safe to breathe and the water safe to drink, under an intact ozone layer that screens out ultraviolet rays, within a climate that is reasonably stable and predictable. I want every man, woman, and child to have enough to eat, a place to sleep, and a chance to live free of violence. I want our political system to serve the common good rather than the wealthiest few. I want our court system to serve justice rather than ideology. I want our economic system to distribute the rewards of labor fairly. I want our medical system to care for the health of all citizens and our schools to nurture the talents of all children. I want our news media to tell the truth. And I want there to be others, many, many others, working to achieve these outcomes. When I reason backward from these desired results to figure out how they might be achieved, I keep finding, as I did in the case of the retired banker, that every step requires imagination. In artists, imagination gives rise to stories that have never been told before, melodies that have never been heard, dances and designs that have never been seen, and it gives rise in turn to pleasures and yearnings, many of them unprecedented, within everyone who reads or listens or watches. In scientists, imagination generates hunches about how some portion of the nature might work, yielding hypotheses that can be tested. It allows them to envision processes unfolding through time and space. In all of us, imagination gives rise to compassion by providing insight into the feelings and thoughts of other people. Consider what a mysterious power this is. We can see things that are not actually present before our eyes. Not only things remembered, such as a childhood bedroom, but also things we have not experienced, such as climbing Mount Denali, as well as things no one has experienced, such as a journey to the stars. We can travel into the past or future while our bodies never budge. We can lay out plans in our minds, step by step, for a meal or a house before lifting a hand. Imagination keeps us from being trapped in the present arrangement of things. We can live in the midst of slavery and envision slavery's abolition. In the midst of a society that oppresses women, we can envision their acquiring rights equal to those of men. In the midst of damaged land and endangered species, we can foresee their restoration. Those who lack imagination accept the present arrangement of things as unalterable. If they are ruled by monarchs or plutocrats, they assume that God or nature has ordained that it be so. Surrounded by racism, perpetual war, savage inequality, or rampant consumerism, they shrug and say, there's no use protesting, that's just the way humans are. But humans have conducted their individual lives and organized their communities in myriad ways. And imaginative people keep trying out new ways of living on every scale, from households to the planet. In Europe, for example, nations that warred with one another for 500 years have formed a union, an imperfect union, to be sure, but one that has at least put an end to their mutual slaughter. In 1989, with a minimum of bloodshed, the Berlin Wall came down and the Soviet Empire collapsed as a result of efforts and sacrifices by countless people who had created discussion groups, cooperatives, unions, black markets, worship circles, underground presses, secret theaters, and other alternatives to the old authoritarian order. In America today, you will hear voices declaring it's futile to resist the few dozen transnational corporations that largely control our legislatures, our courts, our media, food supply, energy delivery, and healthcare system, and that are rapidly gaining control over our schools and communities. Certainly, these corporations can be ruthless in crushing any threat to their profits. Monsanto, for example, has brought lawsuits for patent infringement against farmers whose crops have been contaminated by pollens or seeds from genetically modified varieties that Monsanto itself has loosed into the world. Oil companies have hired mercenaries to put down resistance from indigenous people whose lands they have polluted. Tobacco companies have suppressed studies that demonstrate the lethal effects of their products. And television networks have attacked politicians who advocate breaking up media monopolies. The largest of these corporations dwarf the economies of most nations. In fact, 50 of the world's 100 largest economies are corporations. They answer to no electorate. They intimidate regulators and run roughshod over governments, yet in the majority opinion of our Supreme Court, they are entitled to many of the rights of individual persons. So these behemoths are powerful indeed, but they are not invincible, any more than the former Soviet Union, the apartheid system in South Africa, the British Raj in India, the slave culture of the Old South, or the decades-long dictatorships in contemporary Egypt, Tunisia, and Libya proved to be invincible. All of these seemingly omnipotent regimes have yielded, sooner or later, to the human power of envisioning more benign and just social orders. The American colonists, who refused to accept perpetual rule by a high-handed British king and parliament, formed committees of correspondence to share their grievances. They organized militias, published pamphlets, sent delegates to illegal assemblies, and eventually drew up the Declaration of Independence, one of the boldest human inventions ever, and in the eyes of many people at the time, one of the likeliest and most futile to fail. And yet, with crucial help from France and other sympathetic parties, the rebellious colonies threw off the control of the mightiest empire in the world. The new nation's constitution opened with the words, "We the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union." The power to conceive and work toward a more perfect anything, government, or gadget, novel, or neighborhood, is the gift of imagination. I am well aware that in many instances the overthrow of tyrannical regimes came about through violence, and so I wish to state clearly that I am opposed to violence. I advocate change that comes through peaceful efforts, which is why I champion the inspiration of art, the rational guidance of science, and the ethical constraints of compassion. One sees such change underway right now, for instance, in the proliferation of farmers' markets, food co-ops, community gardens, and organic farms, all of which provide alternatives to industrial agriculture. One sees such change in the formation of land trusts, nearly 2,000 of them now, spread across the United States, protecting millions of acres from chainsaws and bulldozers. One sees such hopeful change in the widespread embrace of green building codes, in the burgeoning of independent news sources through the internet and non-commercial broadcasting. And I would say that Darkwood Brew in this church is an example of that. In the efforts to clean up rivers, restore salmon, rescue whooping cranes from extinction, build houses for the homeless, offer free medical care to the uninsured, or harvest energy from wind and sun. Considered singly, these endeavors might seem trifling compared to the scale of challenges we face. Taken together, however, and viewed as part of a worldwide striving toward a sustainable and caring way of life, they hold out promise bright enough to fire up all but the dullest imagination. Among the challenges we face, the one that requires the liveliest exercise of imagination, if we are to meet it successfully, is the heating of our planet caused by the buildup of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. The neighborhood we must consider is larger than any that Jesus could have conceived, for it encompasses the whole planet. And the neighbors we must care for are not only our contemporaries, but also our descendants. And not only our fellow human beings, but all living things, from aardvarks to zebra swallowtails. Here is a problem unlike any that our species has ever faced, a problem that may either overwhelm us or inspire us to our greatest common endeavor. The initial step, of course, is to imagine that we are, in fact, disrupting the climate by burning fossil fuels and felling forests. As I write this essay, 7 of the 8 announced Republican presidential candidates seem unable, or at least unwilling, to take this minimal step. It is impossible to distinguish, of course, between what they actually believe and what they calculate will garner the most money from fossil fuel companies and the most votes from people reluctant to curb consumption. These politicians may be merely echoing, and there certainly are Democratic versions of the same thing, these politicians may be merely echoing the sentiments of George H.H. Bush when he declared at the end of the 1992 Earth Summit, "The American way of life is not negotiable." That way of life, enjoyed by roughly 4% of the world's population, burns up nearly a quarter of the world's oil production each year, and releases nearly a quarter of the world's greenhouse gases each year. Through our appetite for paper and wood and for meat grown on land cleared for grazing, Americans cause the felling of more trees and therefore the loss of more carbon storage than do any other people on Earth. Let me suppose you are not running for office and you have consulted the testimony of the roughly 98% of atmospheric scientists worldwide who report that Earth's average temperature is rising and that the rise is due primarily to human actions. And let me suppose you are aware that glaciers are retreating, permafrost is melting, ocean levels are rising, coral reefs are bleaching from the warmer waters, forests are dying, deserts expanding, floods are increasing, diseases are moving out of tropical areas, and species are shifting their territories towards higher latitudes or higher altitudes. Let me suppose, in short, that you grasp the basic science of global heating. Knowing what is happening, what should we do about it? As individuals, as societies, and as citizens of the planet. There are those who say we should let the market work it out. As if the sum total of selfish decisions made by consumers, executives, and governments would miraculously produce the best of all possible worlds. There are those who say that the worst effects of global heating will not kick in for another century or so, by which time we'll all be dead. And since the people who will suffer those dire effects have not yet been born, we don't owe them anything. There are those who say that God has set us on this path to punish us, so we must forswear a short list of sins, which usually include abortion, homosexuality. A list that does not include rapacious consumption of Earth's bounty and beauty. And there are those who insist we are doomed to ravage the planet because humans are inherently greedy, short-sighted, and lazy. Well, what would the Golden Rule urge us to do, including the version of it formulated in the Hebrew Bible and in the New Testament? What would it urge us to do? If we took seriously the teaching of Jesus, the Hebrew prophets, the Buddha, or any number of other spiritual guides who espoused this ethical principle, how would we act? Imagine for a moment that you are one of those potential future victims of climate chaos living in the 22nd century. How would you want the people who lived in the early 21st century to behave? Would you want them to pursue the unregulated expansion of a freewheeling market economy driven by self-interest? Would you want them to discount your very existence because you were not yet born? Would you want them to blame environmental deterioration on what they regarded as sexual sins? Would you want them to blame human nature as they keep on driving and flying and shopping at ever-increasing rates? Or would you want them to operate on your behalf by curbing their consumption, placing a tax on carbon to reflect its real cost, and restoring forests? In short, would you want them to love you as they love themselves? Along with love your neighbor as yourself, do unto others as you would have them do unto you, and be the change you wish to see in the world. Another expression of the Golden Rule has lately come into widespread use from the Iroquois tradition. When meeting in council, elders of the Iroquois Nation are expected to make decisions in light of their best understanding of how those decisions might affect the well-being of their descendants 7 generations ahead. It is an attractive ideal, especially as an antidote to our culture's fixation on short-term payoffs. Caring for the 7th generation has become shorthand for an ethical responsibility that extends far beyond immediate cost-benefit calculations, beyond the quarterly report, beyond the next election. The term reminds us that everything we do in our day will affect the conditions for life after we are gone. Likewise, it reminds us that many of the cultural blessings we enjoy, such as universities, libraries, museums, churches, and parks, are inheritances from past generations, as are many of our curses, such as the racism left over from slavery, the pollution from reckless industrialization, and the depletion of topsoil, fisheries, forests, and wildlife from headlong exploitation. We cannot know for certain how our actions will affect our descendants or our fellow species, but science helps us make an informed projection. We can't know unerringly the right way to act, but compassion offers the surest guide. No matter how clear the evidence from science and the testimony from ethics, however, if we are to grapple with climate disruption and other global crises, we also need the active sympathy and imaginative energy aroused in us by art. To be sure, much recent art discourages us from imagining a more perfect world. Turn on television, visit the cinema, or open a best-selling novel, and you're likely to encounter stories about people stalking, robbing, murdering, cheating, or otherwise harming one another. You'll meet far more narcissists than altruists, more desperados than healers, more warriors than peacemakers. It is not surprising that art angling for popularity deals in such fare. Physical threats seize our attention for obvious evolutionary reasons. Strife and destruction are more dramatic than harmony or healing. In art, as in politics, fear is easier to evoke than hope. But the greatest art, while acknowledging the world's brokenness and our own flaws, the greatest art conveys glimpses of a potential wholeness in ourselves and in the world. The word to heal means to make whole. One of our names for that tantalizing wholeness is beauty. Glimpsing it in poetry or pottery, hearing it in symphonies or songs, we long to make something beautiful ourselves. We long to lead beautiful lives. We yearn to walk in beauty, as the Navajo say. Great art reveals that beauty is not a superficial trait, but the expression of a fundamental force running right through the cosmos, including our own depths. This is a healing, a whole-making force, manifest in the way scattered elements gather into stars, the way debris from supernovas gathers into organisms, the way organisms form communities, and in the way our two-legged kind shapes Earth's materials into art. What we call imagination is a human expression of the shaping force, the creative force at work in the universe. The universe was not fashioned all at once with its present distribution of species and stars. It has unfolded over billions of years, and it is unfolding still right this moment, and so is our understanding of how the universe works and what our role in it might be. Everything we presently behold, no matter how far-flung and scattered it may appear, is part of a single flow which generates new forms that cohere for shorter or longer periods and then give way to new, generally more complex forms. On Earth, at least, this dynamic unity has produced organisms capable of responding to the creativity of the universe with creations of their own. We paint and sing and dance and write because we are moved by the artfulness of nature. There is a deep affinity between the glaze on a bowl and the iridescence of a butterfly's wing, between a ballerina's pirouette and the swirl of a spiral galaxy. There is an affinity because they arise from the same impulse. In light of our gifts, it is neither impractical nor utopian to imagine leading more beautiful lives, to imagine forming a more perfect society, to imagine alleviating the suffering and fostering the happiness of strangers not yet born. Like the universe, we are still unfolding. What we become, what we make of ourselves and our world, will be shaped by many factors, but by none more powerful than imagination. Thank you.
You've been listening to a lecture program from the Center for Faith Studies on Noon Forum. We've heard a talk by Scott Russell Sanders, Distinguished Professor Emeritus of English at Indiana University, where he taught from 1971 to 2009, and author of A Private History of Awe and A Conservationist Manifesto. He spoke on the topic, The Way of Imagination. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Thursday evening, October 13, 2011, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Cindy Kugler, Director of the Center for Faith Studies, for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Complete Noon Forum listings, as well as an archive of previous broadcasts, are available on our website, kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.